Welcome to The Procurement Show.
Hello, and welcome to The Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. And my role, actually, I won't tell you what my role is today because I'm really, really excited about this as an episode.
Yeah.
I can hardly contain myself.
This week, we're talking about innovation in procurement, why we're not very good at it and how to do it.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Ruby, your AI negotiation co-pilot.
And to help somebody who doesn't have a background in procurement, which often they make the best guess, yes, if I'm honest, but he does know a lot about innovation because he's written comedy for television for more than 10 years, writing for some big names here in the UK, such as Rory Bremner, Roy Hubb. Is Roy Hudd, not Roy Hubb, isn't it?
Roy Hubb. Who's from Roy Hubb?
I don't know. Roy Hubb. Right, I'm going to just keep going. Writing for big names here in the UK, such as Rory Bremner, Roy Hudd, The News Quiz, Lily Savage, and The 11 O'Clock Show. He's been a stand-up comedian and then decided to get a real job working as a stockbroker in London. Then he started his own business, sold it, and took up copper mining in Zambia, as you do, which involve regular meetings with Zambia's president. He's an accomplished author, having written many thrillers for Penguin, and is now a business strategist and professional speaker, and works with big companies helping turn them around. Please welcome the CEO and founder of BrilliantThinking.com, Felix Riley. Felix, welcome to The Procurement Show. It's great to have you join us today.
Thank you. I can't live up to that introduction. Can we end
that? I was going to say, this is great. You're a comedy writer. You're funny. You look quite suave. You're pretty much everything Jonathan isn't.
I thought you were going to say he looks funny then. I'm really excited about this. We've not had a comedy writer on The Procurement Show before.
We've barely done anything funny.
Actually, the whole Procurement Show is a bit of a joke from start to finish sometimes, isn't it? But what can we learn? What can procurement learn from the world of comedy writing?
So much. As you said with my CV, I've done quite a lot. And nothing gets near comedy writing. Nothing. In terms of value to my, how it shaped my life. Very seriously. The thing about gag writing, you've got two things with comedy writing. You've got to think very differently, very innovatively, because it's creativity, it's just innovation. And you've got to think very innovatively. But the gag writing is the most amazing muscle to develop, because you'll be in a studio with a bunch of people and we'll have to do a joke about, you know, Trump being in Asia or whatever. And someone will crack a joke in the writer's room. And everyone will chuckle, you know, because we're baseball doing with each other and stuff. But in your mind, you go, that's a 20,000-foot joke, you know. And then we'll keep going. And someone cracks a joke and everyone chuckles quite a lot. And you go, oh, that's a 30,000-foot joke. And you want to get to 40,000-foot. That's the goal every single time. So your brain is constantly aspiring to a better idea. It's constantly aspiring to the golden idea that 40,000-foot. And you just don't settle. You can't settle because you won't get paid. You know, it does focus the mind. And honestly, that mindset of good enough isn't good enough has absolutely informed everything I've ever done. And I think the thing as well is, because comedy is very anarchistic, there's no sacred cows. Basically, it's religious things that can't be touched. And because of that, when you get to a new situation, you just don't really mind how it's been done before. You go, well, okay, what would I do if I started from scratch? I don't know if you saw and there's no reason why anyone should, Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, gave a big keynote, hour and a half, so, you know, buckle in. And in it, he said that when we build a new chip, we do not iterate from the existing chip. We don't sort of tweak it and try and improve it and what about if we change this bit. He said, we get a blank piece of paper and we start again. We know loads, we know more than we've ever known, and we just start again. And that's the mindset. And that's a comedy mindset. You know, he'd be a very good gag writer.
So don't build on what went before.
Because then you're tied to it. Because the minute you start just trying to tweak this and tweak that, can we optimize these connectors and blah, blah, blah. I won't get too technical because what do I know about ruddy microchips? But you do, you get tied just by working on what's already there. You get tied to it. And the secret of a huge advance is the David Bowie approach, which is constant reinvention. Because you're not going to forget everything you know. You know, you're not going to design a kitchen sink, are you? You've got all these brains in the room that are going to go from scratch, going, right, now that we know and things have moved on, how do we do it today? And that's what I'm always trying to get companies to do, always. What would you do if you were starting today?
I love the idea of that 20,000-foot joke. Mm. I think on this show, we get to about 2'6" on a regular.
I was going to say, I tried to design a kitchen sink the other day. I felt it drained afterwards.
Now, just because we've got a comedian on the show and a you're trying to be funny now, aren't you?
This
is my opportunity, isn't it, to shine?
Shine.
It's the studio lights in your forehead. Now, I've written lots of things for radio. Most of them in radio commercials, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them in my time. It's not a unique skill, but I've got a unique skill in my head. And if I tried to describe it to somebody, I wouldn't know where to start. It just works. I can't describe it. How would you describe the process of innovating?
I think it's reaching further. I think it's saying, how do we do this better? And I think the brain doesn't automatically do that. The brain settles very early. You know, we have learned helplessness. We have loss aversion, risk aversion. You know, we have status quo biases. The brain doesn't often naturally want to go further. People just say, well, that's good enough. Let's get on with it. You know, which a lot of the times practical way through life. But if you sit there and go, how do we do this better? I'm cooking today. And the recipe didn't last for spinach, but I thought, oh, spinach would be nice. Because I thought, how can I take it further? I've done this before. That's all innovation is. Now, you know, that's actually, if you like, a marginal improvement. But if someone said, all right, you're making salmon en croûte, but just start again, reinvent it, do something better than salmon en croûte. You go, okay, well, I get the ingredients, you know, fish, nice ingredients. Do I deconstruct it? Do I use living fish? You know, and honestly, I don't care if it's food, I don't care if it's a novel, I don't care if it's a multinational company. You know, it's the mindset of going, how do we go further? And the minute you do that, you're out into new territory and you've got to fill that void with new ideas. And you suddenly you're starting to think of 40,000 feet. Because, you know, if we're sitting around and we're talking about a new procurement process and people are familiar, they've got a lot of experience, and someone says, well, why don't we do it like this, this, and this? And I turned around and said, how good is that, that process they've just described? The experienced people might say, that's about 20,000 foot idea. We could do better than that. And then everyone agrees on, let's say, a 30,000 foot idea. And then you go, could we do better? And everyone goes, we could, but we don't know what it is. But we know it's out there. Because I've never worked on an idea that couldn't be improved. Outside of maths, everything can be improved. Outside of laws of nature, everything can be improved. And like NVIDIA, I mean, you know, what they do is insanely stunning. I mean, it's space age stuff. And all the guy was talking about, Jensen was like, we can do better. Well, they're the best in the world. And they're saying, but we can do better. That's the mindset. Then that's how you get there, by saying, we can do better. And we always can.
Did you hear that, Jonathan?
We can do better.
You can do better.
I'm going to write that 100 times on my piece of paper here.
I mean, the real question I want to ask is, how can we make Jonathan's procurement books funny?
I can do better.
You must try harder. Jonathan, why does procurement need to innovate? Is it not comfortable where it is right now?
I'm glad you asked me that question. Because it's exactly what you said just then, Felix. Two things. So the first is starting with a clean sheet of paper. Because so often in procurement, what people do is they say, well, this is the thing we bought before. So we're going to run an RFP and we're going to select a supplier and we're just going to negotiate with them. But you're just doing what you've done before, which just doesn't work so much of the time, which is why we're just not very good at procurement. Actually, really good procurement is to say, this is the need we're trying to fulfill. How can we fulfill that need? And it may be by doing the same thing we did before, but it actually might be by saying, well, look, we can fulfill that need in a different way. So one, if you're in the business of producing some sort of food product or a drink, then, you know, there is a package that you put that in, whether it's a bottle or it's a container or something. So what is the need then? People often say, well, we need to sell our product. We need to put it in a glass bottle and get it to the consumer. Well, the need is actually to be able to get the product to the consumer, not to go and buy glass bottles. So how do you fulfill that need in a different way? Well, there are different ways of getting that product. So you could use plastic, you could use Tetra Pak, you could use some sort of can, you could use some sort of other solution that hasn't been invented yet. So if we start with the need, you can actually tear up what we do before and think about that differently. And then the second bit, which is what you just said, how can we do it better? And again, procurement doesn't ask that question. So the best procurement that I've ever seen is where people innovate and they say, what's the need? And then how can we make this better? And then it completely challenges everything that's gone before.
And now it's time for this week's fun fact.
KFC started life when Colonel Sanders began serving fried chicken and other diner fare to hungry travellers from a cell in prison.
Might want to start that again.
I think I will. KFC started life when Colonel Sanders began serving fried chicken and other diner fare to hungry travellers from a Shell service station that he owned on Route 25 in Kentucky. It all went well until they built the new interstate, which bypassed his location in 1955 and put him out of business. Undeterred, he took to the road to sell franchises and eventually established 400 Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets in just 5 years. Today, there are around 32,000, and the company continues to grow with a new location opening every 3 hours or so.
Wow. Hey, which country's got the most number of KFCs then?
Well, which do you think?
How are we measuring this? Is this per capita?
You just measure it as chicken outlets. How do you measure it? You just, which country has the most KFCs?
Yeah.
You're getting technical.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's obviously not the United Kingdom, the USA.
No, it's not. China.
Really?
China has 10,000 KFC outlets.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
That's a lot of chicken.
The fun fact. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Capella, the guided category strategy creator powered by AI and 5i.
Okay, so to be harsher on the question then, why is that? Is it because procurement's lazy? Is it because it's restricted by compliance? Why?
I think because nobody's ever shown them that it can happen differently. And Felix, you work with a lot of companies. I love working with groups to help them try and be innovative. But it's like you show them, you open this magic thing and the light from the gold inside the box comes out and people go, whoa, I've never seen one of those before. It's like you've shown them something that doesn't exist when it's actually been available to them all the time. You've just shown them. Does that correlate with what you see?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the starting point is to throw out all limitations. So go with a bottle of milk. I mean, look at the way it's been delivered to us over the years. Horse and cart in the shops, all these things, you know, Waitrose comes to the door, blah, blah. But you can take it further. You can say, okay, take all the limits off. I want a bottle of milk right now. What would get it to me as quickly as possible? And someone could say, well, you could get a drone to deliver it to you, and it actually could get to you within about 10 minutes if you want. Now, everyone might start giving lots of reasons why that wouldn't work. Well, they're doing it in China. On rooftops, they have this square where the drone will land, you know, being very smart about it. But you run up and you can get that package you want. And it's incredible. And actually, I think, pardon the pun, but the sky's the limit. And I think we're in an age now where, if you can imagine it, you can pretty much really well do it. And I think the things, the conversations that need to be had is, okay, we need a brainstorm where we go, all bets are off. We do the NVIDIA approach of a blank piece of paper, okay? And the thing about a brainstorm, and it always muses the hell out of me, the amount of times I'm in a brainstorm and you're throwing ideas around and some guy will clutch his proverbial pearls and he'll say, but we can't afford that. We can't afford, typically the FD. Can't afford that. We can't afford that. And you go, hang on, we're not doing it. We're just talking about it. And what happens is most conversations get closed down far too early by a naysayer, typically the FD. But it is, and they do. And what you need to say is, that's a brilliant way to do it, but it doesn't make any economic sense at the moment. Can anyone think of an economic sensible way to do that? And actually, if you push it, you can get to it. Because if I say to myself, yeah, I want a pint of milk and I've got people coming over. I've made my tea cakes. I can't get out. I've got a dog with attachment issues. Whatever your situation is, I would pay £10 for a pint of milk to be delivered.
Yeah.
I just would. There's always a way.
Yeah. Or you could buy a cow. That would be the other way.
Yeah,
maybe.
Indeed. Yeah.
I might not want you in the brainstorm.
Is that how it starts? So if you're going to get companies to innovate, do you start with that brainstorming? If we could do anything, what would we do? Is that the route to do it?
I think it is. I think the traditional way to have a brainstorm is to have one technique, which is divergent thinking, which is lots of ideas. And then you get a short list. And that's great because ideas trigger ideas. A new idea is just an old idea fused with another old idea, but creates a new idea. That's all it is. And they're brilliant. And so lots of ideas is a very good thing. But there's lots of brainstorming techniques, which is one of the things I really sort of go in and try and impress upon people when I'm working with companies. And one of my favorites is no limit, because the minute you have no limit, instead of sort of thinking the reasons not to do something, you say, well, let's put it on the table. And then you go, so can we find a way? So we know, we've all been in brainstorms where someone says, oh, there isn't the time, there isn't the money, there isn't the resources. And if you say, no one's allowed to say that, we put the idea, what's the best idea in the world? And it might be an idea where you go, we can't do that today, but my God, we want to travel towards that. That's a bloody good idea. And that's how great ideas happen. I mean, watching a great speech by Steve Jobs the other day, and he was saying that when he got into business, the thing that surprised him the most was very few people think very deeply about how to improve things. And funnily enough, he was talking about procurement. Of all things, he was talking about the fact that he had a factory where they were making the first Apple Mac. Some of us are old enough to remember. And he said, he went up to a chap running the production line. He said, so how much is this a unit? And the guy said, well, we're not at the end of the quarter. And Steve Jobs said, well, no, well, hang on, we're building them. So how much do they cost per unit? And the guy said, well, we don't know. We have to get all the bills in and adjust them at the end of the quarter, you know. Steve Jobs, well, we don't track it properly. And one of the revolutions he brought about was to say, oh, no, for Apple Mac 2 onwards, everything gets tracked. So that at every point, someone can tell me how much we're spending on X, Y, Z, you know. And he stopped and thought deeply. And the sort of thing that kind of amuses me but breaks my heart as well, because I do care about the people I work with, is everyone wants Apple's success. But then when you go on, do what Apple does, which is think deeply. And they go, oh, we've got time.
Yeah, I love the convergence of ideas thing there. So you could have a drone deliver a cow to your rooftop.
You hear me?
Keep going with it.
Taking that idea, obviously that's perhaps an innovation that may not necessarily work. I'm sorry to say, Jonathan.
You're being like the FD now.
I know, but it does lead me on to ask the question, because surely there must be situations, you're being very positive, very upbeat and very pro-innovation, but surely there must be occasions and examples where innovation does in somehow, some way backfire. How do we consider and face the realism that there is the possibility of failure, and how do we manage failure?
First of all, I'm never, ever advocating for recklessness. I'm advocating for restlessness. It's really important to me. And I don't understand any entrepreneur who's not constantly restless. And the other thing is, I think we need to bake failure in, because failure means we're pushing at the limits. You know, the old thing with stand-ups is that they say, you don't know where the line is until you cross it, which I've done a few times. And that's okay, you know, and it should be the same in business. I saw this interview on CBS recently, 60 Minutes, and it was the head of NASA was being interviewed. And the interviewer said, look, I don't want to be rude, but I've got a question that I'm afraid you're not going to like. He said, NASA started the game in America. They, you know, you've had decades of experience in doing this. What a head start. Then SpaceX has come along and rushed past you on the outside. What have you got wrong? And the head of NASA gave the longest sigh I've ever seen on television. And he just said, we're not allowed to make mistakes. He said, that's when you learn so fast. One error, Congress would be all over us. He said, you know, SpaceX can blow a rocket up every week. And that mindset, one thing that people don't realize is that the most successful companies in the world fail the most. The most successful venture capital companies have the most failed investments. Apple, IBM, Amazon, Google fail all the time because they are constantly trialing new services, new products, because they know that's how you innovate, that's how you get ahead. They're constantly trialing them, and the vast majority fail. And they go, yeah, fair enough. Oh, well, you have to try. I mean, AWS, which of course now dominates the world of sort of server data provision and stuff, it was an accident. It was in-house for Amazon. They said, oh, let's stop outsourcing this. Let's do it. So, and someone said, you know, we have a lot of downtime and spare capacity, and we could just push this out there. And then, boom, they accidentally found it. And Amazon was the first to say, we don't know a lot about success. You know, we didn't know in advance. And that mentality, Jeff Bezos says that innovation and failure are inseparable twins. And he's so right. And if people want to be stagnant and stay safe, I get that human instinct. But we are in a world where we have so many tools to innovate now. And I think that restlessness, we know in advance is something reckless. I'm not saying, you know, just drive everything off a cliff just to save money on getting down the road. But I think we should be trialing. I think every serious company should be trialing things all the time.
You work with big organizations, you work with small companies, you work with startups across lots of different industries. Is there a group or an industry or a type of organization that's really good at innovation? And I guess conversely, is there one that's really rubbish at innovation other than NASA?
Let me think. Well, the government ones really struggle. So I work with the NHS and what have you, and I work with, back to work with the MOD and what have you, and they're not even oil tankers. They are small islands that they're trying to turn around. And that's death by bureaucracy. And that's really, really hard. And I sympathize. I've got no criticism of them at all, actually. I get it. And obviously, one should look at that and go, right, how do we innovate? How would you shake that up? That's obviously the exercise in itself there. But the ones that are, I think, the most adaptable, I think, well, I mean, you know, I work with a lot of startups. Some of them just have to ditch their idea before they start. You know, that space where you're just about to start, you've just started, unless you are solving a problem. There's a wonderful, who is it? I think it might have been Sam Altman, because he was part of the Y Incubator, wasn't he, back in the day? And he said that the question he used to ask companies was, why should you exist? And I love that. I mean, that's a really good question, actually, because I say this to lots of law firms, amazing people, bloody smart, obviously. But I always say to them, and I say this to big global management consultancy companies, look, you know, why would anyone choose you? Which is another way of saying, is a politer version of saying, why should you exist? And people rarely have a good answer. You know, what they do is they kind of pitch themselves in the mix with everyone else.
Why should you exist?
Well, thank you very much.
I just, you know, unless
sat in a studio by yourself otherwise.
You don't just have to do this at a company level, can you? You could do this at an individual level.
I guess you could. Yeah. You probably lose a lot of friends that way.
Why should you exist?
Yeah.
We'll be right back in just a moment.
Strategic thinking. Category management. Negotiation. SRM. Sustainable procurement.
Imagine if the skill set your team needs could happen at the flick of a switch. At Positive Purchasing, we have 22 years' experience in building advanced procurement and negotiation capability. With our unique skills assessment and tailored learning and development programs, it's no wonder we're the partner of choice for big companies the world over. Ready to switch on procurement capability that makes an impact in your business? Contact Positive Purchasing today to find out how.
You could ask AI that question, because the reason why I'm going there,
know.
Well, Felix mentioned Sam Altman, obviously the CEO of OpenAI. So let's talk about AI for a little bit. How can it help drive innovation in this style, or does it stifle human ingenuity? Are we being lazy when we go to use it? How can we use it right?
No, I think AI is a really handy tool. That's the end. It can't do creativity. The thing about creativity is, apart from the fact, you know, by definition, it can't have original ideas because it is the wisdom of crowds. It is giving you the amalgam of everything that's out there. So by definition, it can't be original. Mm. And also creativity, and I think people miss this when it comes to artistry and a lot of innovative thinking, is you have a perspective. The point about Picasso, Matisse and Jane Austen, whatever, they had a perspective. And that's what you buy into when you love an artist's work and what have you. But also people like Steve Jobs had a perspective. He was obsessed with products that served the customer best. He built from the customer backwards, which was not that common. Most people said, oh, I can build a laptop and this will be cheap. Let's get it out there with the best screen we can. Thanks very much. And he was like, no, what's the most beautiful thing with the best user experience? And got it out to them. So I think AI, you know, it's got its limits when it comes to creativity. I think what I love, I'm excited about with AI, and I use this every day, I'm sure you guys probably do as well, is it gets rid of a lot of my grunt work, which frees me up. It frees me up to think. The smart use of people's time is to pause and think, to think deeply, as per Steve Jobs, and then to implement those new ideas. And so if AI can free us up, give us more time to think, more time to reflect, more time to interact with teams and help each other and push each other and boost each other, that's bloody marvellous. So that gets me excited. It's not intelligent. I mean, that's a joke. Intelligence requires consciousness. So artificial intelligence is a propaganda term in itself. It's silly. It's a massive overhyped term. But I think it's really useful. I mean, the way it can contextually offer you answers and write emails for you and things, bloody brilliant. You know, I'm a big fan of that.
And we're talking entrepreneurial skills here. And I was fortunate enough, I got to meet Richard Branson, have a half an hour conversation with him. And there's so much I wanted to ask him, but I wanted to ask him about how he was an entrepreneur. And one of the things, if you've ever been fortunate enough to travel with Virgin Atlantic Airways in their upper class section, which is just wonderful.
Before you got through, no.
Yeah. Obviously, that's the only way that you travel.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
But there's a bar there. And he was the first airline operator to put a bar on an aeroplane. And he said, right, using the Steve Jobs analogy, customer-centric, if we put a bar on there, it creates this experience. People will come in. If they're not traveling in upper class, they'll come in through there and they'll see it and they'll aspire to want to do that. And it creates this experience which will sell the brand. And the accountant said, no, you're going to lose so much revenue. And I asked him about this. And he said, yeah, you know, the accountant actually said, this is how much revenue we will lose because it'll take out 5-6 business class seats. You know, don't do it. And he said, no, I want to do it because it will work. And it did. And a lot of the airlines followed and did the very same thing. But it takes that entrepreneurial mind to say, this is what I think will work. Ignore the naysayers. And when I translate that back to procurement, we don't do entrepreneurial. We stifle it. The whole process of RFPs stop innovation dead. We reward procurement people for not innovating. But now more than ever, we need entrepreneurs. Now, not everybody naturally has that stuff. People aren't naturally Richard Branson or Steve Jobs. How can you teach someone to become entrepreneurial? Or can you teach someone to become entrepreneurial?
Yeah, you can. You definitely can. Dare I say it, number one quality is grit. When I look at all the entrepreneurs I've worked with, all the really outstanding leaders, she'll have grit all day long. And that ability, Richard Branson style, to go, yeah, we're doing it anyway. I went around an adult disability home with a client of mine who said, well, come and be my sane brain because I'm going to get sentimental and want to buy. Because it was in special measures and it was Hearts Council phoned up and said, please save this because otherwise we're going to have to disperse the residents to the four corners of the country, you know. And she went along and everything I'd had in the report, which I didn't like, was getting worse as I walked around. I mean, the place, the fixtures and fittings needed changing. She would be liable for that. The roof had problems. She'd be liable for that. But it's a money pit. And we got to the end and she said, come on, what do you think? Be honest with me. And I said, oh, it's a no. I'm really sorry, but it's a no. And she said, so we're buying it, yeah. But she's made it work because she's got grit. That's the number one thing. But sorry, back to your question. But it actually are linked because grit is about pushing through. Maybe my hero, but certainly one of my heroes is Ken Robinson, the amazing educationist. He did the most popular TED talk ever, which I recommend to everybody. It's amazing. About creativity, actually. And it quotes this case where they got people to have divergent ideas. And what they did is they gave them an object, like a brick or a paperclip, and said, give us as many uses as you can in 5 minutes. And some people get 10, some people get 15, 20, whatever. You know, but some people get 200, you know, because paperclip, their brain goes wild. You know, they might say, well, if it's a 10-foot paperclip? You didn't tell me it was not a 10-foot paperclip, and they go crazy with it, you know. They did this test with 1,500 people, and above a certain amount, they called it innovation at genius level. And he asks the audience, you know, what percentage do you think of people hit genius level? And people start shouting out numbers. And he said, oh, sorry, I should have added one more thing. The people being tested were 3 to 5 year olds. And he said, yeah, 98%. Just brilliant. I won't be told that people aren't naturally innovative in their thinking. We get it beaten out of us by education. We get it beaten out of us by workplace as well, because we stigmatize failure at school and we stigmatize failure in the workplace.
Yeah. But it's still there somewhere.
Oh, it's there, you know. I had a friend around the other day, he's an amazing composer. I only move in very lofty circles, I should have said that. He's an old school friend, but he's amazing. Oliver Davis, shout out. And he was talking to me about, you give these talks on creativity and innovative thinking. What's your formula? And I said, well, you have to embrace 4 things. And I said, you have to embrace failure. You have to be willing to fail, unless you're willing to take risks and learn from your mistakes. You have to embrace different perspectives, because, of course, you get stimuli from lots of areas. You get criticisms and feedback from lots of areas. You have to embrace the reality. It takes bloody work. It's hard. It is bloody hard being creative and innovative. And fourthly, you have to embrace your inner child. And my friend was nodding the whole way along, because totally agreed. But when I got to inner child, and this is a very lofty composer, said, oh, yeah, yeah, that's the one. You know what I mean? And it's true, because, and this is a lofty composer. He does ballets and all these things. But he's like, yeah, yeah, I'm just being a chub, you know, I'm playing. So if you can get a room of people to play and just sort of loosen up and have a bit of fun. One of the reasons I always crack jokes when I'm giving my talks is it keeps people's minds lighter. If you hit them with scary statistics and this is going to happen, all this sort of doom and gloom nonsense, everyone tightens up. And what you want is everyone loose as a goose and just open.
Teaching
everyone
to be children.
To get people back to the childlike state, which you two, I can see, have got a head start.
We definitely have, yeah.
I've never grown up,
no,
if I'm honest.
No, you've just grown out. Am I right in thinking, Felix, before we started recording, I think Jonathan said you actually written pantomimes, is that right?
Because we get listened to all over the world.
We do.
I'm just going to explain what a pantomime is for our American listeners.
Not international. Yeah.
So pantomime, how can I describe it? It's a peculiar part of British theatre where the boys play the parts of the girls, the girls play the parts of the boys, and the hero has no peripheral vision and can't see people creeping up on him.
Yes, that's about right. Yeah.
So that's pantomime.
Yeah.
Over to you, Felix.
Yes, I did the pantomime for Radio 4 one year. I was given the script and said, can you do a whole rewrite? And I said, it's not funny enough. We just need jokes, jokes, jokes.
Yeah.
And the guy said, no, we need heart. We need heart. I said, yeah, there's plenty of heart. We need jokes. It's a pantomime.
I've got to explain, because we're an international podcast. So Radio 4 is a radio station here in the United Kingdom. It's the fourth one from the BBC.
It's a big one.
So would you describe procurement then as one big pantomime? And if procurement was a pantomime, what would be the plot?
I'm trying to think of what fairy tale we'd go for. Hansel and Gretel, accepting that you've got to somehow leave at some stage. I would have loved a bit of warning for that question. I think suffice to say, the best of procurement is behind them. I think every single area is up for grabs in terms of thinking. Procurement, I get excited if I worked in procurement, because you can now say we can buy it from anywhere. It can get delivered anyhow. The process doesn't have to be from the warehouse to us anymore. We can go from the warehouse to the customer or whatever, you know. There's every variation you can think of. And if it doesn't exist, you can make it exist. Now, it doesn't mean at the first blush that you'd have a profitable, sensible way forward. But that's where you go, okay, we like that way forward. How do we make that work? And Amazon, of course, has been brilliant. It's been mind-boggling the way it has innovated. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that ethically everything's wonderful. But it has, and it has shown you the art of the possible. And I always say to my clients, funnily enough, a lot of my clients are looking to innovate and all that. So first and foremost, make sure you've foraged. Make sure you've gone around and looked at the competition and how anyone does anything. And make sure you're taking the best techniques of everybody else, best practice. And then worry about it. Because what I would find amazing in procurement and so many other areas I work in is people who, right in front of them, they have a better way of doing things and they don't. And you go, wow, that tells me a lot. Probably all I need to know.
And now it's time for this week's Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Ethan Brooks in the UK, who asks, dear Jonathan, we hear lots of talk about how AI is and will change everything that procurement does, but we don't talk much about data. In all the companies I've worked in, it's always been the data or lack of it that stopped us being good. Surely with AI, this is even more of a concern. My question to you is, if we don't have good data to start with, can AI really transform us?
That's a great question, Ethan. Thank you very much for that. And the good news is we're going to do a whole podcast on that. Ooh. Next month, We've got Andy Simmons from ProcureView, who's going to come on and talk about data. In essence, no data, no AI. That's how it works. If you train the AI on poor data, you get rubbish out, hallucinations and so on. Also, AI is super data hungry. For it to do what we need it to do, it needs much more data than we even have available now. So you've got to have really good data. And the traditional principles of data, you've got to get the data, you've got to be able to clean it, normalize it, make sure it's all coded in the same way, look after it, keep it clean, and have it in some master location so everybody can use it. That's still very much the case, but those sort of master locations are more cloud-based now rather than necessarily within the organization. But the key thing here is, as we get more and more data, we really need to pay attention to how we manage that data. But the way in which we acquire it will be different, because we assume today that we're going to go and have the data we need to do stuff. But as we use more and more AI-powered systems, there will be scenarios where we'll need multiple data points throughout a supply chain to give us real-time view of what's happening in that supply chain and with that supplier at that time. That's not data we'll store, but we'll need systems that go and get that data from the supplier, from points in the supply chain, from maybe satellite imagery, from whatever things we're measuring, and bring it back and allow us to do something with that that analyzes a particular situation. So the future is about making sure we've got really good, clean, well-maintained master data and the ability to go and get all the other data we need using next generation AI powered systems. No data, no AI. Data powers everything.
So are you saying that perhaps there isn't enough data available now in order to drive this?
Correct. Imagine the future procurement systems, and you're able to see in real time everything that happens in your suppliers, right back up the supply chains, and you're able to model if customer demand shifts or something happens, or there's a geopolitical event in the world like war breaks out, or there's a crop failure, or there's a catastrophe somewhere, then all of those data points will drive some sort of agile system that immediately repivots our category strategy, our supplier strategy, and then changes how we're sourcing and what we're doing. You know, this is the thing of fiction today, but that's what procurement systems in the future will do. That won't be possible with a master data set that sits in-house. You need 100 times the data points to be able to do that. But future systems will do that.
Yeah, is it also a case of the data that we've got, we haven't retained it and we haven't maintained it and we haven't got enough data points historically, so moving forward we need to make sure we have all that streaming information coming in.
As a minimum, and then augment that with all the other stuff that we're going to need as well.
Interesting. And as Jonathan said, we're going to have a special on that, so make sure you subscribe to the feed, and also if you've got a question, make sure you get in touch. Here's how.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing and Proclius, the Strategic Procurement Toolkit, Academy and AI-powered workflow.
I want to take some of the things that you've spoken about and challenge them with Jonathan. And ask Jonathan, in procurement, we're very much stuck in processes and systems, aren't we? Would you say we're stuck in them too much? And are those processes and systems never going to go away, and therefore innovation just simply isn't going to happen?
I think we are stuck in process and system, especially for transactional procurement. And what's interesting, back to AI, is that is transforming how we do that. So the idea of having these processes to do things will be embedded within future systems, which in itself is a form of innovation. But I think the systems that we've had over the years are the ones that have constrained us. But at the same time, you know, there's a reason why organizations need these systems. The reason why organizations run RFPs is because they don't know what the market can offer. So you go through a process, often not a very good one, and because organizations don't trust people to ensure that things are let fairly and correctly. Now, all of those things can be taken care of with systems that understand marketplaces and can make sure that the way in which choices are made, decisions are made, and contracts are let are done correctly. So we take away that fear, that need to overcome human inadequacies by a new system that will do that.
But if you take RFPs, I've worked for many years with a big old digital transformation company. Their bread and butter is RFPs, win some, you lose some. And actually, if you step back, can you imagine being a client? Harrods decides it wants to get 5 responses to an RFP. What if Harrods could actually say, well, actually, instead of responding to the RFP, can you all just get in the room and give us your best ideas for every part of it? Could you? Now, no one does that because everyone says, well, why would we do that? But that's what I'd want. I'd want to say, I want the best ideas in the room. And then you go, well, that's really hard. How'd you compensate? And you go, I don't know, but it's worth thinking about. Because what you do is you end up with someone's worldview. Okay, we're going to go with this company and the way they do it. But actually, what you want is the best of everything. Now, obviously, in RFPs, you do sort of say, this other customer wanted to do this. Can we make sure we do this? Whatever. But actually, what if you had a proper brainstorm and you got people in and said, we just want the best ideas here, and I'm sorry we're only going to use one of you, or we might figure out where you all work together. I don't care. We just want what's best for us. Again, RFPs, by their very nature, as you say, they're practical, but I've watched them for years thinking they're so limiting in what people
get.
To a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And all these providers are running around with their own hammer.
Yeah, and the providers have constrained innovation because they've taken something that used to be done with paper, Word documents, and made it into a checkbox. And if you're trying to understand how a supplier can bring innovation and good practice, you can't do that because you're actually assuming that you know more about what the supplier does than the supplier can tell you, and not then giving the supplier the opportunity to share that with you. So it is pretty broken. It does absolutely stifle innovation.
All right then, Felix, I want to put you on the spot. So we've talked a lot about innovation and idea theory, I guess you could call it, but actually, how do we do it? Can you give us some practical tips about how we can move away from listening to this podcast and go and start being innovative?
You have to make the time to think. I do away days all the time, which I love, because what I love about away days, people are very clearly demonstrated they're taking time out to have a think.
But you know, everyone will come back to you and say they're time poor.
I know they will. And what a false economy, because if you are run ragged and you haven't got time to think, I find that terrifying. You're running an operation and you haven't got time to think. That's scary to me. If you're running a company and you don't have a bank of time that you can use, I don't think you're running it that well. Are you going to have times when it's like that? And of course there are. But there should be a bank of time, which is thinking time. Because otherwise, you're pushed by events. And if you're pushed by events, I don't know what you're doing. I mean, that's insane to me. That would be terrifying. Don't get me wrong. I've got loads of friends who are in that situation. I've had clients where they're exhausted. But actually, the way you get out of that is by stopping and having a think. The first thing I would say, stop and have a think and start with a blank piece of paper. Forget how we do things. What would be the dream way to do it from where we are? And what happens is, if you're being conservative, you end up with an idea, you can adapt into what you're already doing. But you might find an idea that's just so exciting. And the thing as well, and this is one thing I really try to impress upon people, when you have a brainstorm where you have a very exciting idea, what happens is everyone knows they're working on an exciting idea that's probably more profitable or will make you happier, whatever it is. And then morale goes up, productivity goes up, because suddenly people know, oh, this is really worthwhile. I mean, the amount of people I know, you know, who are working on things where they don't believe in it. It's grunt work, or there's people over there doing it in a much better way, but we do it this way. That's madness to me. So you have to find time to think. Otherwise, you are the victim of events. And if that's a way you're willing to run your company, wow. There is always half a day. I'm working with a global charity at the moment, and we're getting together for a brainstorm, ideas for raising money. And I spoke to the head of fundraising recently, and he said, look, we need to put something in the diary, Felix. So how much time do we need for this? And I said, well, I'd give it a day, you know, to really bot this out, you know, to have a really good brainstorm with lots of different techniques and all these things. And he said, no, there's no way we're going to get everyone's diaries sorted out for a day. He said, can we shoot for half a day? And I said, it's your party, do you want? So we're sorting out the diaries. And I said, just out of interest, if I could somehow magically guarantee you that by the end of a day's brainstorm, we would have ideas that would raise you at least a million more next year, would you book out a day? And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. And I said, so what are we doing? Have a bit of faith. And that's the reality. And that, honestly, that summed up for me how most people think about stopping to brainstorm.
Yeah, I've seen that.
If you could magically promise them you'll double your profits in 3 years if you take this day out, everyone would say yes.
I think brainstorming is still seen as a sort of touchy feeling thing, isn't it? That it's not real work. We're not out there challenging suppliers. And
it's a jolly.
It's a jolly. Yeah. It's often seen like that. I've done similar sessions. And once you get everybody in a room, you get that energy. People go, wow, we can do that. The trick is, of course, then taking that and doing something with it as a next step. But it's brainstorming such a powerful thing. But I think we can't leave without getting you to tell us a joke. Because of your comedy writing history. And I'm looking for 40,000 foot, maybe 50,000 foot here.
All the jokes I know, we cannot sail.
Well, we can do a Christmas edit of this.
Yeah, I think I'll tell you the last joke I heard.
Okay.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
There's an American guy goes into a pub in London and he slaps £500 on the bar and he says, that's £500 for anyone who can drink 10 pints of beer in one go. Go on, £500. And everyone looks at him a bit nervously and he says, come on, has anyone got the guts? And one Irish guy stands up and says, I think I could have a go at that. And the American goes, come on then, you know. But the Irish guy runs from the pub and everyone's standing there. And about 20 minutes later, he comes in, walks up to the bar and says, 10 pints of ale. And the barman gives him 10 pints of ale. He knocks them all back in one go, wins his £500. And the American goes, you know, it's really impressive. He goes, well, hell, that was amazing. But where did you go for 20 minutes? And he goes, well, I went next door to make sure I could actually do it.
That's 50,000 foot.
The Irishman's the hero in that joke.
Yeah.
So I'm Irish.
And I'm Irish. That's okay.
There you go. Fine.
So you've given us food for thought. Let's talk about food. Let's not actually, but let's talk about takeaways. What are your top three takeaways from today's discussion? I think one of them will be thinking time. Take time to think. See, I thought about that then.
Making time to think, don't have limits on a brainstorm. That is a killer. And really need saying, there's no bad ideas in a brainstorm. You have to make people feel really safe. That psychological safety thing we're all so excited about at the moment. Because I've been in too many brainstorms over the years, and I've done this for a long time, where the best idea was triggered by the worst idea. You have to let them all in. Dennis Publishing does car magazines, Lads Mags, wonderful company. And Felix Dennis was the owner, and he would sometimes turn up at the editorial meetings unannounced. And my friend said, we had to let him in. He owned the company. But for those who don't know on your listenership, Felix Den was an entrepreneur, a drug addict, and a poet, kind of like a benign Elon Musk. And he would come into his meeting, and my friend said he would machine gun out ideas. I mean, just pour them out. And my friend said 8 of these ideas were bat-ass crazy.
Yeah.
Just wow. So bad, how did they come out of your mouth? Bad. And my friend said, one of them would be all right. He said, one would be brilliant. Just brilliant. And he said, it really taught me to respect the process, that people need to be allowed to work through bad ideas. You don't have meetings where you shoot someone down. I don't care how bad an idea is. We might laugh together at it occasionally, but you never put a person down, because that's a really big thing. So make the time and don't put any limits on the thinking. The word no is not allowed, honestly. It's the only place the word no is not allowed. And thirdly, there's no such thing as a bad idea, because they can trigger the best idea.
Felix Riley, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great, actually, and I've learned so much. We've learned that procurement's not a joke. We've learned you can drop a cow from a drone. We've learned you've got to embrace the inner child, and it's important to stop and think. Thank you for joining us on The Procurement Show. It's been a delight to have you with us. Bye-bye.
It's a complete delight for me as well.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and visit us at theprocurementshow.com. You can also WhatsApp us on +44 7396 939933. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, transforming procurement with exceptional tools and advanced training. Produced in the UK by Fresh Air Studios. The Procurement Show is copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved.
Negotiating is a bit like building muscle. Without the muscle, you won't get the results. But the more you train, the stronger you get. And before you know it, you'll be the strongest. Build your negotiation muscle today. Train your team in Red Sheet Negotiation and watch them win.
Yes.
Visit Red Sheet Negotiation and find out how the top-performing companies negotiate.